This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Unaccustomed Earth by Jhumpa Lahiri. Read for you by Sarita Chowdhury and Ajay Naidu. Part 1. Human nature will not flourish any more than a potato if it be planted and replanted for too long a series of generations in the same worn-out soil. My children have had other birthplaces, and, so far as their fortunes may be within my control, shall strike their roots into unaccustomed earth. Nathaniel Hawthorne, The Custom House. Unaccustomed Earth. After her mother's death, Ruma's father retired from the pharmaceutical company where he had worked for many decades and began traveling in Europe, a continent he'd never seen. In the past year, he had visited France, Holland, and most recently, Italy. They were package tours, traveling in the company of strangers, riding by bus through the countryside, each meal a museum and hotel prearranged. He was gone for 2, 3, sometimes 4 weeks at a time. When he was away, Ruma did not hear from him. Each time she kept a printout of his flight information behind a magnet on the door of the refrigerator. And on the days he was scheduled to fly, she watched the news to make sure there hadn't been a plane crash anywhere in the world. Occasionally a postcard would arrive in Seattle, where Ruma and Adam and their son Akash lived. The postcards showed facades of churches, stone fountains, crowded piazzas, terracotta rooftops mellowed by late afternoon sun. Nearly 15 years had passed since Ruma's only European adventure, a month-long Eurorail holiday she'd taken with two girlfriends after college, with money saved up from her salary as a paralegal. She'd slept in shabby pensions, practicing a frugality that was foreign to her at this stage of her life, buying nothing but variations of the same postcards her father sent now. Her father wrote succinct, impersonal accounts of the things he had seen and done. Yesterday, the Uffizi Gallery. Today, a walk to the other side of the Arno. A trip to Siena scheduled tomorrow. Occasionally, there was a sentence about the weather. But there was never a sense of her father's presence in those places. Ruma was reminded of the telegrams her parents used to send to their relatives long ago, after visiting Calcutta and safely arriving back in Pennsylvania. The postcards were the first pieces of mail Ruma had received from her father. In 38 years, he'd never had any reason to write to her. It was a one-sided correspondence. His trips were brief enough so that there was no time for Ruma to write back, and besides, he was not in a position to receive mail on his end. Her father's penmanship was small, precise, slightly feminine. Her mother's had been a jumble of capital and lowercase, as though she'd learned to make only one version of each letter. The cards were addressed to Ruma. Her father never included Adam's name or mentioned Akash. It was only in his closing that he acknowledged any personal connection between them. "Be happy, love Baba," he signed them, as if the attainment of happiness were as simple as that. In August, her father would be going away again to Prague. But first he was coming to spend a week with Ruma and see the house she and Adam had bought on the east side of Seattle. They'd moved from Brooklyn in the spring for Adam's job. It was her father who suggested the visit, calling Ruma as she was making dinner in her new kitchen, surprising her. After her mother's death, it was Ruma who assumed the duty of speaking to her father every evening, asking how his day had gone. The calls were less frequent now, normally once a week on Sunday afternoons. "You're always welcome here, Baba," she told her father on the phone. "You know you don't have to ask." Her mother would not have asked. "We're coming to see you in July," she would have informed Ruma, the plane tickets already in hand. There had been a time in her life when such presumptuousness would have angered Ruma. She missed it now. Adam would be away that week, on another business trip. He worked for a hedge fund and since the move had yet to spend 2 consecutive weeks at home. Tagging along with him wasn't an option. He never went anywhere interesting, usually towns in the Northwest or Canada, where there was nothing special for her and Akash to do. In a few months, Adam assured her the trips would diminish. He hated stranding Ruma with Akash so often, he said, especially now that she was pregnant again. He encouraged her to hire a babysitter, even a live-in, if that would be helpful. But Ruma knew no one in Seattle, and the prospect of finding someone to care for her child in a strange place seemed more daunting than looking after him on her own. It was just a matter of getting through the summer. In September, Akash would start at a preschool. Besides, Ruma wasn't working and couldn't justify paying for something she now had the freedom to do. In New York, after Akash was born, she'd negotiated a part-time schedule at her law firm, spending Thursdays and Fridays at home in Park Slope. And this had seemed like the perfect balance. The firm had been tolerant at first, but it had not been so easy. Dealing with her mother's death, just as an important case was about to go to trial. She had died on the operating table of heart failure. Anesthesia for routine gallstone surgery had triggered anaphylactic shock. After the 2 weeks Ruma received for bereavement, she couldn't face going back. Overseeing her clients' futures, preparing their wills and refinancing their mortgages felt ridiculous to her, and all she wanted was to stay home with Akash, not just Thursdays and Fridays, but every day. And then, miraculously, Adam's new job came through, with a salary generous enough for her to give notice. It was the house that was her work now, leafing through the piles of catalogs that came in the mail, marking them with post-its, ordering sheets covered with dragons for Akash's room. "Perfect," Adam said, when Ruma told him about her father's visit. "He'll be able to help you out while I'm gone." But Ruma disagreed. It was her mother who would have been the helpful one, taking over the kitchen, singing songs to Akash and teaching him Bengali nursery rhymes, throwing loads of laundry into the machine. Ruma had never spent a week alone with her father. When her parents visited her in Brooklyn, after Akash was born, her father claimed an armchair in the living room, quietly combing through the Times, occasionally tucking a finger under the baby's chin, but behaving as if he were waiting for the time to pass. Her father lived alone now, made his own meals. She could not picture his surroundings when they spoke on the phone. He'd moved into a one-bedroom condominium in a part of Pennsylvania Ruma did not know well. He had pared down his possessions and sold the house where Ruma and her younger brother Romy had spent their childhood, informing them only after he and the buyer went into contract. It hadn't made a difference to Romy, who'd been living in New Zealand for the past 2 years, working on the crew of a German documentary filmmaker. Ruma knew that the house, with the rooms her mother had decorated, and the bed in which she liked to sit up doing crossword puzzles, and the stove on which she'd cooked, was too big for her father now. Still, the news had been shocking, wiping out her mother's presence just as the surgeon had. She knew her father did not need taking care of, and yet this very fact caused her to feel guilty. In India, there would have been no question of his not moving in with her. Her father had never mentioned the possibility, and after her mother's death, it hadn't been feasible. Their old apartment was too small. But in Seattle, there were rooms to spare, rooms that stood empty and without purpose. Ruma feared that her father would become a responsibility, an added demand, continuously present in a way she was no longer used to. It would mean an end to the family she'd created on her own, herself and Adam and Akash, and the second child that would come in January, conceived just before the move. She couldn't imagine tending to her father as her mother had, serving the meals her mother used to prepare. Still, not offering him a place in her home made her feel worse. It was a dilemma Adam didn't understand. Whenever she brought up the issue, he pointed out the obvious, that she already had a small child to care for, another on the way. He reminded her that her father was in good health for his age, content where he was. But he didn't object to the idea of her father living with them. His willingness was meant kindly, generously, an example of why she loved Adam, and yet it worried her. Did it not make a difference to him? She knew he was trying to help, but at the same time she sensed that his patience was wearing thin. By allowing her to leave her job, splurging on a beautiful house, agreeing to having a second baby, Adam was doing everything in his power to make Ruma happy. But nothing was making her happy. Recently, in the course of conversation, he'd pointed that out, too.
How freeing it was these days to travel alone with only a single suitcase to check. He had never visited the Pacific Northwest, never appreciated the staggering breadth of his adopted land. He had flown across America only once before, the time his wife booked tickets to Calcutta on Royal Thai Airlines via Los Angeles, rather than traveling east as they normally did. That journey was endless, Four seats, he still remembered, amongst the smokers at the very back of the plane. None of them had the energy to visit any sites in Bangkok during their layover, sleeping instead in the hotel provided by the airline. His wife, who had been most excited to see the floating market, slept even through dinner, for he remembered a meal in the hotel with only Romy and Ruma in a solarium overlooking a garden, tasting the spiciest food he'd ever had in his life as mosquitoes swarmed angrily behind his children's faces. No matter how they went, those trips to India were always epic, and he still recalled the anxiety they provoked in him, having to pack so much luggage and getting it all to the airport, keeping documents in order and ferrying his family safely so many thousands of miles. But his wife had lived for these journeys, and until both his parents died, a part of him lived for them too. And so they'd gone, in spite of the expense, in spite of the sadness and shame he felt each time he returned to Calcutta, in spite of the fact that the older his children grew, the less they wanted to go. He stared out the window at a shelf of clouds that was like miles and miles of densely packed snow one could walk across. The sight filled him with peace. This was his life now, the ability to do as he pleased, the responsibility of his family absent just as all else was absent from the unmolested vision of the clouds. Those returns to India had been a fact of life for him and for all their Indian friends in America. Mrs. Bagchi was an exception. She had married a boy she'd loved since girlhood, but after 2 years of marriage he was killed in a scooter accident. At 26, she moved to America, knowing that otherwise her parents would try to marry her off again. She lived on Long Island, an anomaly, an Indian woman alone. She had completed her doctorate in statistics and taught since the 70s at Stony Brook University, and in over 30 years she had gone back to Calcutta only to attend her parents' funerals. Meenakshi was her name, and though he used it now when he addressed her, in his thoughts he continued to think of her as Mrs. Bagchi. Being the only two Bengalis in the tour group, naturally they'd struck up a conversation. They started eating together, sitting next to one another on the bus. Because of their common appearance and language, people mistook them for husband and wife. Initially, there was nothing romantic. Neither of them had been interested in anything like that. He enjoyed Mrs. Bagchi's company, knowing that at the end of a few weeks she would board a separate plane and disappear. But after Italy, he'd begun thinking of her, looking forward to receiving her emails, checking his computer 5 or 6 times a day. He searched MapQuest for the town she lived in to see how long it would take him to drive to her home, though they had agreed for the time being to see each other only when they were abroad. Part of the route was familiar to him, the same path that he and his wife used to take to visit Ruma in Brooklyn. He would soon see Mrs. Bagchi again, in Prague. This time they'd agreed they would share a room, and they were thinking in the winter of taking a cruise in the Gulf of Mexico. She was adamant about not marrying, about never sharing her home with another man, conditions which made the prospect of her companionship all the more appealing. He closed his eyes and thought of her face, which was still full, though he had guessed she was probably almost 60, only 5 or 6 years younger than his wife. She wore Western clothing, cardigans, and black pull-on slacks and styled her thick dark hair in a bun. It was her voice that appealed to him most, well modulated, her words always measured as if there were only a limited supply of things she was willing to say on any given day. Perhaps, because she expected so little, he was generous with her, attentive in a way he'd never been in his marriage. How shy he'd felt asking Miss Bagchi for the first time in Amsterdam after they had a tour of the Anne Frank house to pose for a photograph in front of a canal.
Ruma had offered to drive to the airport and greet her father, but he insisted on renting a car and following directions off the internet. When she heard the sound of tires on the gravel drive, she started picking up the toys that were scattered across the living room floor, putting away the plastic animals, and closing the books that Akash insisted on leaving open to his favorite pages. "Turn off the television, Peanut," she called out to him now. "Don't sit so close to the screen. Come, Dadu's here." Akash was lying motionless on the floor, on his stomach, his chin cupped in his hands. He was a perfect synthesis of Ruma and Adam. His curly hair they'd never cut, and his skin a warm gold, the faint hair on his legs gold as well, reminding her of a little lion. Even his face with its slanted, narrow green eyes had a faintly leonine aspect. He was only 3, but sometimes she already felt the resistance, the profound barrier she assumed would set in with adolescence. After the move, he he'd grown difficult. It was a combination, she knew, of the new surroundings and her lack of energy and Adam being away so much. There were times Akash would throw himself without warning on the ground, the body she had nurtured inside her utterly alien, hostile. Either that or he was clingy, demanding that she hold him while she was trying to make a meal. Though she had mentioned nothing about the baby, she was convinced that he'd figured it out already, that already he felt replaced. She had changed, too. She was less patient, quicker to say no instead of reasoning with him. She hadn't been prepared for how much work it was, how isolating it could be. There were mornings she wished she could simply get dressed and walk out the door like Adam. She didn't understand how her mother had done it. Growing up, her mother's example, moving to a foreign place for the sake of marriage, caring exclusively for children and a household, had served as a warning, a path to avoid. Yet this was Ruma's life now. She walked across the living room, turned off the television. "Answer me when I talk to you, Akash. Get up. Let's go." The sight of her father's rental car, a compact maroon sedan, upset her, freshly confirming the fact that she lived on a separate coast thousands of miles from where she grew up, a place where her parents knew no one, where neither of her parents, until today, had set foot. The connections her family had formed to America, her parents' circle of Bengali friends in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, her father's company, the schools Ruma and Romy had gone through, did not exist here. It was 7 months since she'd last seen her father. In the process of selling and packing up their old apartment, moving and settling into the new house, and her father's various trips, over half a year had gone by. Akash got up and trailed behind her, and together they watched as her father opened the trunk of the car, lifting out a small black suitcase with wheels. He was wearing a baseball cap that said Pompeii, brown cotton pants, and a sky blue polo shirt and a pair of white leather sneakers. She was struck by the degree to which her father resembled an American in his old age. With his gray hair and fair skin, he could have been practically from anywhere. It was her mother who would have stuck out in this wet, northern landscape in her brightly colored saris, her dime-sized maroon bindi, her jewels. He began to pull the suitcase along the driveway, but because of the inconvenience of the gravel under the wheels, he picked it up by the handle and walked across the grass up to the house. She saw that it was a slight struggle for him, and she wished Adam were there to help.
"Akash, is that you?" her father called out in mock bewilderment in English. "So big you have become."
By now, Akash had forgotten the little Bengali Ruma had taught him when he was little. After he started speaking in full sentences, English had taken over, and she lacked the discipline to stick to Bengali. Besides, it was one thing to coo at him in Bengali, to point to this or that, and tell him the corresponding words, but it was another to be authoritative. Bengali had never been a language in which she felt like an adult. Her own Bengali was slipping from her. Her mother had been strict, so much so that Ruma had never spoken to her in English. But her father didn't mind. On the rare occasions Ruma used Bengali anymore, when an aunt or uncle called from Calcutta to wish her a happy Bijoya, or Akash a happy birthday, she tripped over words, mangled tenses. And yet it was the language she had spoken exclusively in the first years of her life.
"How old now? 3? Or is it 300? Her father asked.
Akash did not respond, behaving as if her father did not exist. "Mummy, I'm thirsty," he said. "In a minute, Akash." Her father seemed the same to her. For a man of 70, the skin of his hands and face was firm and clear. He had not lost weight, and the hair on his head was plentiful, more so, she feared, than her own after Akash's birth, when it had fallen out in clumps on her pillow each night. The crushed strands, the first thing she noticed every morning. Her doctor assured her it would grow back, but her bathtub was still filled with shampoos that promised to stimulate scalp growth, plump the shafts. Her father looked well-rested, another quality Ruma did not possess these days. She had taken to applying concealer below her eyes, even when she had no plans to leave the house. In addition, she had been putting on weight. With Akash, she had lost weight in her first trimester, but this time, at just 12 weeks, she was already 10 pounds heavier. She decided it must have been the food she found herself always finishing off of Akash's plate, and the fact that now she had to drive everywhere instead of walk.
She'd already ordered pants and skirts with elastic waistbands from catalogs, and there was a solidity to her face that upset her each time she looked in the mirror. "Akash, please say hello to Dadu," she said, giving him a gentle push behind the shoulder. She kissed her father on the cheek. "How long did it take you to get here? Was there traffic?" "Not so much. Your home is 22 miles from the airport." Her father always made it his business to know the distances he traveled, large and small. Even before MapQuest existed, he knew the exact distance from their house to his office, and to the supermarket where her parents shopped for food, and to the homes of their friends. "Gasoline is expensive here," he added. He said this matter-of-factly, but still she felt the prick of his criticism as she had all her life, feeling at fault that gas cost more in Seattle than in Pennsylvania. "It's a long flight, you must be tired."
"I'm only tired at bedtime. Come here,"
her father said to Akash. He set down the suitcase, bent over slightly, and put out his arms. But Akash pressed his head into Ruma's legs, refusing to budge. They came inside, her father leaning over to untie the laces of his sneakers, lifting one foot at a time, wobbling slightly.
"Baba, come into the living room. You'll be more comfortable doing that sitting down on the sofa," Ruma said.
But he continued removing his sneakers, setting them in the foyer next to the mail table, before straightening and acknowledging his surroundings.
"Why does Dadu take his shoes off?" Akash asked Ruma.
"He's more comfortable that way."
"I want shoes off too."
Akash stomped his sandals on the floor. It was one of the many habits of her upbringing which she'd shed in her adult life, without knowing when or why. She ignored Akash's request and showed her father the house, the rooms that were larger and more gracious than the ones that had sheltered her when she was a child. Akash trailed behind them, darting off on his own now and then. The house had been built in 1959, designed and originally owned by an architect, and Ruma and Adam were filling it slowly with furniture from that period. Simple, expensive sofas covered with muted shades of wool, long, low bookcases on outwardly turned feet. Lake Washington was a few blocks down a sloping street. There was a large window in the living room framing the water, and beyond the dining room was a screened-in porch with an even more spectacular view. The Seattle skyline to the left, and straight ahead, the Olympic Mountains, whose snowy peaks seemed hewn from the same billowing white of the clouds drifting above them. Ruma and Adam hadn't planned on living in a suburb, but after 5 years in an apartment that faced the backs of other buildings, a home so close to a lake from which they could sit and watch the sunset was impossible to resist. She pointed out one of the two bridges that spanned the lake, explaining that they floated on pontoons at their centers because the water was too deep. Her father looked out the window, but said nothing. Her mother would have been more forthcoming, remarking on the view, wondering whether ivory curtains would have been better than green. It appeared, as her father walked from one end of the living room to another, that he was inwardly measuring its dimensions. She remembered him doing this when he helped her to move in the past, into dorm rooms and her first apartments after college. She imagined him on his tours in public squares, walking from one end to another, pacing up and down a nave, counting the number of steps one had to ascend in order to enter a library or a museum. She took him downstairs where she had prepared the guest room. The space was divided into two sections by an accordion door. On one side was the bed and a bureau, and on the other, a desk and sofa, bookcase and coffee table. She opened the door to the bathroom and pointed to the wicker basket where he was to put his laundry. "You can close this off if you like," she said, pulling at the accordion door to demonstrate.
"It's not needed," her father said.
"All the way, Mommy," Akash said, tugging at the handle, causing the folded cream-color panel to sway back and forth.
"Close it all the way."
"No, Akash."
"This is my room when I get bigger," Akash announced.
"That little TV in the corner works, but it's not hooked up to cable," Ruma told her father. 9 is the PBS station," she added, knowing those were the programs he was fond of.
"Hey, don't walk on my bed with your shoes on,"
her father said suddenly to Akash, who had gotten onto the bed and was walking with large, deliberate steps around the bed cover. "Peanut, get off the bed." For a moment, Akash continued exactly as he was doing, ignoring them. Then he stopped, looking suspiciously at his grandfather.
"Why?"
Before Ruma could explain, her father said,
"Because I will have nightmares."
Akash dropped his head. Quickly, to Ruma's surprise, he slithered onto the floor, briefly crawling as if he were a baby again. They went back upstairs to the kitchen. It was the room Ruma was most proud of, with its soapstone counters and cherry cupboards. Showing it off to her father, she felt self-conscious of her successful life with Adam, and at the same time she felt a quiet slap of rejection gathering from his continued silence that none of it impressed him.
"Adam planted all this?" her father asked, taking in the garden that was visible through the kitchen window, mentioning Adam for the first time.
"No, it was all here."
"Your delphiniums need watering."
"Which are they?" she asked, embarrassed that she did not know the names of the plants in her own backyard. He pointed.
"The tall purple ones."
It occurred to her that her father missed gardening. For as long as she could remember, it had been his passion, working outdoors in the summer, as soon as he came home from the office, staying out until it grew dark, subjecting himself to bug bites and rashes. It was something he'd done alone. Neither Romy nor Ruma had ever been interested in helping, and their father never offered to include them. Her mother would complain, having to keep dinner waiting until 9 at night.
"Go ahead and eat," Ruma would say, but her mother, trained all her life to serve her husband first, would never consider such a thing.
In addition to tomatoes and eggplant and zucchini, her father had grown expert over the years cultivating the things her mother liked to cook with, bitter melon and chili peppers and delicate strains of spinach. Oblivious to her mother's needs in other ways, he had toiled in unfriendly soil, coaxing such things from the ground. He glanced at the gleaming six-burner stove with its thick red knobs and then, without asking, began to open one of the cupboards.
"What are you looking for? Do you have a kettle?"
She opened the pantry.
"I'll make tea, Baba." "Let me water your delphiniums. They won't survive another day."
He took the kettle from her hands and filled it at the sink. Then he carried it, slowly and carefully, through the kitchen door outside, taking oddly small steps, and for the first time since his arrival, she saw that in spite of his clear eyes and skin, her father had become an old man. She stood by the window and watched her father water the flowers, his head bent, his eyebrows raised. She listened to the sound of water hitting the earth in a forceful, steady stream. It was a sound that vaguely embarrassed her, as if he were urinating in her presence. Even after the sound stopped, her father stood there for a moment, tipping the spout and pouring the final drops that the kettle contained. Akash had followed her father outside, and now he stood a few feet away, looking up at his grandfather with curiosity. Akash had no memory of her mother. She had died when he was 2, and now, when she pointed her mother out in a photograph, Akash would always say,
"She died,"
as if it was something extraordinary and impressive her mother had done. He would know nothing of the weeks her mother had come to stay with Ruma after his birth, holding him in the mornings in her kaftan as Ruma slept off her postpartum fatigue. Her mother had refused to put him in the bassinet, always cradling him for hours at a time in her arms. The new baby would know nothing of her mother at all, apart from the sweater she had knit for Akash, which he had already outgrown, and which the new baby would eventually wear. There was a half-knit cardigan patterned with white stars still on its needles, one of the few items of her mother's Ruma had kept. Of the 218 saris, she kept only 3, placing them in a quilted zippered bag at the back of her closet, telling her mother's friends to divide up the rest. And she had remembered the many times her mother had predicted this very moment, lamenting the fact that her daughter preferred pants and skirts to the clothing she wore, that there would be no one to whom to pass on her things.
He went downstairs to unpack, arranging his 2 pairs of pants in one of the drawers of the bureau, hanging his 4 checkered summer shirts on hangers in the closet, putting on a pair of flip-flops for indoors. He shut his empty suitcase and put it in the closet as well, and placed his kit bag in the bathroom at the side of the sink. The accommodations would have pleased his wife. It had always upset her, the fact that Ruma and Adam used to live in an apartment, with no separate room for them to sleep in when they stayed. He looked out at the yard. There were houses on either side, but the back felt secluded. One could not see the water or the mountains from here, only the ground, thick with the evergreen trees he'd seen on the sides of the highway that were everywhere in Seattle. Upstairs, Ruma was serving tea on the porch. She had brought everything out on a tray. A pot of Darjeeling, the strainer, milk and sugar, and a plate of nice biscuits. He associated the biscuits deeply with his wife, the visible crystals of sugar, the faint coconut taste. Their kitchen cupboard always contained a box of them. Never had he managed to dip one into a cup of tea without having it dissolve, leaving a lump of beige mush in the bottom of his cup. He sat down and distributed gifts. For Akash, there was a small wooden plane with red propellers and a marionette of Pinocchio. The boy began playing with his toys immediately, tangling up Pinocchio's strings and demanding that Ruma fix them. There was a hand-painted cruet that had the word Olio on its side for Ruma, and a marbled box for Adam, the sort of thing one might use for storing paper clips. Mrs. Bakchi had chosen everything, spending nearly an hour in a toy shop, though she had no grandchildren. He had mentioned nothing to Ruma or Romy about Mrs. Bakchi, planned to say nothing. He saw no point in upsetting them, especially Ruma now that she was expecting again. He wondered if this was how his children had felt in the past, covertly conducting relationships back when it was something he and his wife had forbidden, something that would have devastated them. It was Ruma and his wife who were supposed to have gone on the first of his trips to Europe. In the year before she died, his wife had begun to remark that although she'd flown over Europe dozens of times in the process of traveling from Pennsylvania to Calcutta, she had never once seen the canals of Venice, or the Eiffel Tower, or the windmills and tulips of Holland. He had found his wife's interest surprising. Throughout most of their marriage, it had been an unquestioned fact that visiting family in Calcutta was the only thing worth boarding a plane for. "They show so many nice places on the Travel Channel," she would remark sometimes in the evenings. "We can afford it now. You have vacation days that are wasting away." But back then, he had no interest in taking such a trip. He was impervious to his wife's sudden wanderlust. And besides, in all their years, they had never taken a vacation together, alone. Ruma had organized as a 64th birthday present a package tour to Paris for her mother and herself. She scheduled it during the summer, a time Adam could take Akash to her in-law's place on Martha's Vineyard. Ruma put down a deposit at the travel agency and sent her mother tapes to learn conversational French and a guidebook filled with colorful pictures. For a while, he would come home from work and hear his wife up in her sewing room, listening to the tapes on a Walkman, counting in French, reciting the days of the week. The gallstone surgery was scheduled accordingly, the doctor saying that 6 weeks would be more than enough time for her to recover before traveling. Ruma took the day off from work and came down with Akash for the procedure, insisting on being there even though he'd said there was no need. He remembered how irritated he'd felt in the waiting room over how long it was taking, that feeling vivid in a way the surgeon's news still was not. That information and the chronology of events that followed remained hazy to him, listening to the surgeon say his wife was dead, that she had reacted adversely to the rocuronium used to relax her muscles for the procedure, he and Ruma taking turns with Akash as they went in to see the body. It was the same hospital where Ruma had been a candy striper, where he had once rushed to the emergency room after Romy broke his arm on a soccer field. A few weeks after the funeral, one of his colleagues at work suggested that he take a vacation, and it was then that he'd remembered the trip Ruma and his wife had planned. He asked Ruma if she still intended to go, and when she said no, he asked if it would be all right for him to reserve the tour in his own name. "Did you like Italy?" Ruma asked him now. She sat with the Pinocchio on her lap, clumsily untwisting the strings. He wanted to tell her that she was going about it wrong. There was a knot in the center that needed to be undone first. Instead, he replied to her question, saying that he had liked Italy very much, commenting on the pleasant climate, the many piazzas, and the fact that the people, unlike most Americans, were slim. He held up his index finger, waving it back and forth. "And everyone still smokes. I was nearly tempted to have a cigarette myself," he said. He had smoked when she was little, a habit he acquired in India but abandoned in his 40s. He remembered Ruma, never Romy or his wife, pestering him about quitting, hiding his packs of Winstons or removing the cigarettes when he wasn't aware of it and replacing them with balled-up tissue paper. There was the time she'd cried all night, convinced after her teacher at school had talked about the dangers of smoking that he would die within a handful of years. He had done nothing back then to comfort her. He'd maintained his addiction in spite of his daughter's fear. He'd been attached to a small brass ashtray in the house, shaped like a Nagrai slipper with a curling pointed toe. After he quit, he threw out all the other ashtrays in the house. But Ruma, to his puzzlement, appropriated his favorite, rinsing it out and keeping it among her toys. He recalled that she and her friends would pretend it was the glass slipper in Cinderella, trying to get it to fit over the unyielding plastic feet of her various dolls. "Did you?" she asked him now.
"What?"
"Have a cigarette in Italy." "Oh no, I'm too old for such things," he said, his eyes drifting over to the lake. "What did you eat there?" she asked. He remembered one of the first meals the group had had, lunch at a restaurant close to the Medici Palace. He'd been shocked by the amount of food, the numerous courses. The marinated vegetables were enough for him, but then the waiters brought out plates of ravioli, followed by roasted meat. That afternoon, a number of people in the group, including him, went back to the hotel to recover, foregoing the rest of the sightseeing. The next day, their guide told them that the restaurant lunches were optional as long as everyone met back at the next designated place and time. And so, he and Mrs. Bagchi began to wander off together, picking up something small, commenting with amazement that there had once been a time when they too were capable of eating elaborate lunches, as was the custom in India.
"I tried one or two pasta dishes," he said, sipping his tea. "But mainly, I ate pizza."
"You spent 3 weeks in Italy and all you ate was pizza?"
"It was quite tasty pizza."
She shook her head. "But the food there is so amazing."
"I have videos," he said, changing the subject. "I can show them later if you like."
They ate dinner early, Ruma saying that her father must be hungry from the journey, and her father admitting that he was eager to turn in, that it was, after all, 3 hours later on the East Coast. She spent the past 2 days cooking, the items accumulating one by one on the shelves of the refrigerator, and the labor had left her exhausted. When she cooked Indian food for Adam, she could afford to be lazy. She could do away with making dal or served salad instead of a chorchori. "Is that all?" her mother sometimes exclaimed in disbelief on the phone, asking Ruma what she was making for dinner. And it was in such moments that Ruma recognized how different her experience of being a wife was. Her mother had never cut corners. Even in Pennsylvania, she had run her household as if to satisfy a mother-in-law's fastidious eye. Though her mother had been an excellent cook, her father never praised her for it. It was only when they went to the homes of others, and he would complain about the food on the way home, that it became clear how much he appreciated his wife's talent. Ruma's cooking didn't come close, the vegetables sliced too thickly, the rice overdone, but as her father worked his way through the things she had made, he repeatedly told her how delicious it was. She ate with her fingers, as her father did, for the first time in months, for the first time in this new house in Seattle. Akash sat between them in his booster seat, wanting to eat with his fingers too, but this was something Ruma had not taught him to do. They did not talk about her mother, or about Romy, the brother with whom she had always felt so little in common, in spite of their absurdly matching names. They did not discuss her pregnancy, how she was feeling compared to last time, as she and her mother surely would have. They did not talk very much at all. Her father never wanted to be conversant during meals. His reticence was one of the things her mother would complain about, one of the ways Ruma had tried to fill in for her father. "It is still so light outside," he said eventually, though he had not lifted his eyes from his plate since he'd started eating, had seemed, as he so often did to Ruma, oblivious to his surroundings. "The sun doesn't set until after 9 in the summer," she said. "Sorry the bagunis broke apart," she added. "I didn't let the oil get hot enough." "It doesn't matter, try it," he told Akash, who for the past 4 months refused to eat anything other than macaroni and cheese for dinner. To Ruma, he added, pointing to Akash's plate, "Why do you buy those things? They are filled with chemicals." When Akash was younger, she had followed her mother's advice to get him used to the taste of Indian food and made the effort to poach chicken and vegetables with cinnamon and cardamom and clove. Now he ate from boxes. "I hate that food," Akash retorted, frowning at her father's plate. "Akash, don't talk that way,"
In spite of her efforts, he was turning into the sort of American child she was always careful not to be, the sort that horrified and intimidated her mother. Imperious, afraid of eating things. When he was younger, he'd eaten whatever her mother had made for him. "You used to eat Dida's cooking," she said. "She used to make all these things." "I don't remember Dida," Akash said. He shook his head from side to side as if denying the very fact she was ever alive. "I don't remember it. She died." She was reading stories to Akash before his bedtime when her father knocked softly on the door, handing her the receiver of the cordless phone. He was holding up his right hand awkwardly in front of his chest, and she saw that it was soapy from dishwater. "Adam is on the phone." "Baba, I would have done those. Go to sleep." "'Tis only a few things." Her father had always done the dishes after the family had eaten. He claimed that standing upright for 15 minutes after a meal helped him to digest. Unlike Rumah, unlike her mother, unlike anyone Rumah had ever known, her father never ran the water while he soaped everything. He waited until the plates and pans were ready to be rinsed, and until then, it was only the quiet, persistent sound of the sponge that could be heard. She took the phone. "Rum?" she heard Adam say. That was what he'd begun to call her soon after they met. The first time he wrote her a letter, he'd misspelled her name, beginning, "Dear Room." She pictured him collapsed on the bed in a hotel room in Calgary, where he'd gone this time, his shoes off, his tie loosened, ankles crossed. At 39, he was still boyishly handsome, with the generous, curling brown blonde hair that Akash had inherited, a whittled marathoner's body, cheekbones she secretly coveted. Were it not for the powerful depth of his voice and the glasses he wore these days for distance, he could still pass for one of the easygoing athletic boys she went to college with. "My dad's here." We spoke. "What did he say?" "The usual questions. How are you? How are your parents?" It was true. This was all her father ever had to say to Adam. "Have you eaten?" There was a pause before he replied. She realized he must have been watching something on the television as they were speaking. "I'm about to head off to dinner with a client. How's Akash?" "Right here," she put the receiver to his ear. "Say hi to Daddy." "Hi," Akash said without enthusiasm. Then silence. She could hear Adam saying, "What's going on, buddy? Having fun with Dadu?" But Akash refused to engage any further, staring at the page of his book, and eventually she put the phone back to her own ear. "He's tired," she said. "He's about to fall asleep." "I wish I could fall asleep," Adam said. "I'm wiped." She knew he'd been traveling since early morning, that he'd been working all day, would have to work through his dinner. And yet she felt no sympathy. "I can't imagine my father living here," she said.
"Then don't ask him to."
"I think the visit is his way of suggesting it."
"Then ask."
"And if he says yes?"
"Then he moves in with us."
"Should I ask?" She heard Adam breathing patiently through his nose. "We've been over this a million times, Rum. It's your call. He's your dad." She turned a page of Akash's book, saying nothing.
"I need to get going," Adam said. "I miss you guys."
"We miss you too," she said. She hung up the phone, putting it beside the framed photograph on the bedside table, of Rum and Adam on their wedding day, slicing into the tiered white cake. She could not explain what happened to her marriage after her mother's death. For the first time since they'd met, at a dinner party in Boston when she was a law student and he was getting his MBA, she felt a wall between them, simply because he had not experienced what she had, because both his parents were still living in the house in Lincoln, Massachusetts, where Adam had been raised. It was wrong of her, she knew, and yet an awareness had set in that she and Adam were separate people leading separate lives. Though his absences contributed to her isolation, sometimes it was worse, not better, when Adam was home. Even with Akash to care for, part of her was beginning to prefer the solitude, without Adam hovering around, full of concern about her state of mind, her mood. 10 years ago, her mother had done everything in her power to talk Rumah out of marrying Adam, saying that he would divorce her, that in the end he would want an American girl. Neither of these things had happened. But she sometimes thought back to that time, remembering how bold she'd had to be in order to withstand her mother's outrage and her father's refusal to express even that, which had felt more cruel.
"You are ashamed of yourself, of being Indian. That is the bottom line," her mother had told Ruma again and again. She knew what a shock it was. She'd kept her other involvements with American men a secret from her parents until the day she announced that she was engaged. Over the years, her mother not only retracted her objections but vehemently denied them. She grew to love Adam as a son, a replacement for Romy, who had crushed them by moving abroad and maintaining only distant ties. Her mother would chat with Adam on the phone, even when Ruma was not at home, emailing him from time to time, carrying on a game of Scrabble with him over the internet. When her parents visited, her mother would always bring a picnic cooler filled with homemade mishti, elaborate syrupy cream-filled concoctions which Ruma had never learned to make, and Adam loved. It was after she had had a child that Ruma's relationship with her mother became harmonious. Being a grandmother transformed her mother, bringing a happiness and an energy Ruma had never witnessed. For the first time in her life, Ruma felt forgiven for the many expectations she'd violated or shirked over the years. She came to look forward to their nightly conversations, reporting the events of her day, describing what new things Akash had learned to do. Her mother had even begun to exercise, getting up at 5 in the morning, wearing an old Colgate sweatshirt of Ruma's. She wanted to live to see her grandchildren married, she'd said. There were times Ruma felt closer to her mother in death than she had in life, an intimacy born simply of thinking of her so often, of missing her. But she knew that this was an illusion, a mirage, and that the distance between them now was infinite, unyielding.
After finishing with the dishes, he dried them and then scrubbed and dried the inside of the sink, removing the food particles from the drainer. He put the leftovers away in the refrigerator, tied up the trash bag, and put it into the large barrel he'd noticed in the driveway, made sure the doors were locked. He sat for a while at the kitchen table fiddling with a saucepan whose handle he'd noticed while washing it was wobbly. He searched in the drawers for a screwdriver and, not finding one, accomplished the task with the tip of a steak knife. When he was finished, he poked his head into Akash's room and found both the boy and Ruma asleep. For several minutes he stood in the doorway. Something about his daughter's appearance had changed. She now resembled his wife so strongly that he could not bear to look at her directly. That first glimpse of her earlier standing on the lawn with Akash had nearly taken his breath away. Her face was older now, as his wife's had been, and the hair was beginning to turn gray at her temples in the same way, twisted with an elastic band into a loose knot. And the features, haunting now that his wife was gone, the identical shape and shade of the eyes, the dimple on the left side when they smiled. In spite of his jet lag, he had trouble falling asleep, was distracted by the sound of a motorboat cutting now and then across the lake. He sat up in bed, flipping absently through an issue of U.S. News and World Report which he'd taken from a seat pocket on the plane, and then opened a guidebook to Seattle that had been placed on the bedside table, he guessed, for his benefit. He glanced at the photographs of the new library and coffee shops and the whole salmon displayed on beds of ice. He read about the average yearly rainfall and the fact that it seldom snowed. Studying a map, he was surprised by how far he was from the Pacific Ocean, not realizing until now that mountains stood in the way. Though he had traveled such a distance, his surroundings did not feel foreign to him as they had when he went to Europe. There, he was reminded of his early days in America, understanding only a word or two of what people said, handling different coins. Here, as on a summer night in Pennsylvania, moths fluttered against the window screen, and sometimes an insect would bang against it, startling him with its force. From his position in bed, he took in the spacious, sparsely furnished room. When he was Ruma's age, he had lived with his wife and children in a small apartment in Garden City, New Jersey. They'd converted a walk-in closet into a nursery when Romy and then Ruma were born. He had worried for his family's safety in that apartment complex, the surveillance cameras in the lobby making him nervous rather than putting him at ease. But at the time, still working on his PhD in biochemistry, it was the best he could afford. He remembered his wife making meals on the electric stove in the tiny kitchen, the room smelling afterward of whatever she'd prepared. They lived on the 14th floor, and she would dry her saris one by one over the narrow balcony railing. The bedroom in which Romy and Ruma had both been conceived was dreary, morning light never penetrating, and yet he considered it still the most sacred of spaces. He recalled his children running through the rooms, the pitch of their young voices. It was a part of their lives only he and his wife carried with them. His children would only remember the large house he'd bought in the suburbs with willow trees in the backyard, with rooms for each of them and a basement filled with their toys. And compared to where Ruma now lived, even that house was nothing, a flimsy structure that he always feared could burn down from the flame of a match. Now that he was on his own, acquaintances sometimes asked if he planned to move in with Ruma. Even Mrs. Bagchi mentioned the idea, but he pointed out that Ruma hadn't been raised with that sense of duty. She led her own life, had made her own decisions, married an American boy. He didn't expect her to take him in, and really, he couldn't blame her. For what had he done when his own father was dying, when his mother was left behind? By then, Ruma and Romy were teenagers. There was no question of his moving the family back to India, and also no question of his 80-year-old widowed mother moving to Pennsylvania. He had let his siblings look after her until she too eventually died. Were he to have gone first, his wife would not have thought twice about moving in with Ruma. His wife had not been built to live on her own, just as morning glories were not intended to grow in the shade. She was the opposite of Mrs. Bagchi that way. The isolation of living in an American suburb, something about which his wife complained and about which he felt responsible, had been more solitude than she could bear. But he enjoyed solitude, as Mrs. Bagchi did. Now that he had retired, he spent his days volunteering for the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania, work he could do from his computer at home. And this, in addition to his trips, was enough to keep him occupied. It was a relief not to have to maintain the old house, to mow and rake the lawn, to replace the storm windows with screens in summer, only to have to reverse the process a few months later. It was a relief, too, to be living in another part of the state, close enough so things were still familiar, but far enough to feel different. In the old house, he was still stuck in his former life, attending by himself the parties he and his wife had gone to, getting phone calls in the evenings from concerned friends who routinely dropped off pots of chicken curry, or, assuming he was lonely, visited without warning on Sunday afternoons. He was suddenly tired, his vision blurring and the words in the guidebook lifting off the page. Beside the small pile of books, there was a telephone. He set the book down, lifted the receiver, checked for a dial tone, and set it down again. Before coming to Seattle, he had given Mrs. Bagchi his daughter's phone number in an email, but it was understood that she was not to call. She had loved her husband of 2 years more than he had loved his wife of nearly 40. Of this he was certain. In her wallet, she still carried a picture of him, a clean-shaven boy in his 20s, the hair parted far to one side. He didn't mind. In a way, he preferred knowing that her heart still belonged to another man. It was not passion that was driving him at 70 to be involved, however discreetly, however occasionally, with another woman. Instead, it was the consequence of being married all those years, the habit of companionship. Without his wife, the thought of his own death preyed on him, knowing that it might strike him just as suddenly. He'd never experienced death up close. When his parents and relatives had died, he was always continents away, never witnessing the ugly violence of it. Then again, he had not even been present technically when his wife passed away. He had been reading a magazine, sipping a cup of tea from the hospital cafeteria. But that was not what caused him to feel guilty. It was the fact that they'd all been so full of assumptions. The assumption that the procedure would go smoothly. The assumption that she would spend one night in the hospital and then return home. The assumption that friends would be coming to the house 2 weeks later for dinner, that she would visit France a few weeks after that. The assumption that his wife's surgery was to be a minor trial in her life and not the end of it. He remembered Ruma sobbing in his arms as if she were suddenly very young again and had fallen off a bicycle or been stung by a bee. As in those other instances, he had been strong for her, not shedding a tear.
Sometime in the middle of the night, she'd woken up in Akash's bed and stumbled into her own. Normally, Akash came into her bed at dawn, falling asleep beside her for another few hours before waking her up and wanting cereal. She didn't mind Akash coming into her bed, especially when Adam was out of town. But this morning the bed was empty. She no longer felt sick in the mornings. Instead, her first thought was of food. She wanted a burrito, or one of the egg and cheese sandwiches from the bagel shop near their old apartment in Park Slope. A reminder that all through the night, as she slept, her body had been hard at work. In the kitchen, she saw that the dinner dishes, washed and dried, were at one side of the countertop. In the drainer was a clean bowl, spoon, juice glass, and mug. Beside the stove, on a saucer, was a drying tea bag, reserved for a second use. She heard Akash's voice coming from somewhere outside, but couldn't see him through the window. She went out onto the porch, where the sound of his voice was more distinct. "But I didn't see a turtle," she heard him say, and she gathered that he and her father had taken a walk down to the lake. She took her prenatal vitamin, put on water for tea. She was making toast when her father and Akash came in through the kitchen door.
"We went to the lake and Dadu put me into a movie," Akash said excitedly, pointing to the video camera strung around her father's neck.
"You're wet," she observed, noticing that the straps of his sandals and the front of his shorts were darkened by water. She turned to her father. "What happened?"
"Nothing, nothing. We saw a turtle and Akash wanted to touch it," he said to Ruma. "He's asking for cereal."
"Come on, first you need to change," she said to Akash. When she returned, she saw that her father had opened the cupboard.
"Is this the one he takes?"
he asked, holding up a box of Cheerios. She nodded. "When did you wake up, Baba?"
"Oh, I was up before 5. I sat on the porch and had my breakfast, and then Akash joined me and we went outside."
"I can take over," she said, watching her father pour milk into the cereal bowl.
"I don't mind. Have your food."
She opened the fridge for butter and jam, prepared her tea. When she was finished, her father took the kettle, put the dried-out tea bag into the same cup that was in the dish drainer, and added the remaining hot water.
"Dadu, outside?"
Akash said, tugging on her father's pants.
"Soon, Babu, let me finish."
As she ate her breakfast, she mentioned the places they could see during the course of his visit. Before his arrival, she had looked up hours of admission, ticket prices, and in her mind, she had already conceived of an itinerary, something to keep them occupied each day. She hadn't had the time or energy to explore much of downtown Seattle, and thought the week with her father would provide the opportunity.
"There's the Space Needle, of course," she began, "and Pike Place Market. There's an aquarium along the waterfront I'd been meaning to take Akash to. They have ferry rides across Puget Sound that are supposed to be nice. We could go to Victoria for the day. And then there's the Boeing factory, if you're interested. They give tours."
"Yes," her father said. He looked tired to her, his eyes small behind his glasses.
"To be honest," he said, "I wouldn't mind a rest from all that."
She was confused. She had assumed her father would want to see Seattle with his video camera, just as he was interested in seeing so many other places in the world these days.
"Well, otherwise there's not much else to do here." "I don't need to be entertained."
"That's not what I meant. Whatever you'd like, Baba." Her confusion was followed by worry. She wondered if there was something he wasn't telling her. She wondered how it was in the condominium, whether there were too many stairs to climb, if he had any neighbors who knew or cared about him. She remembered a statistic she'd heard about long-term spouses typically dying within 2 years of one another, the surviving spouse dying essentially of a broken heart. But Ruma knew that her parents had never loved each other in that way.
"Are you all right?"
He looked up at her. He'd been leaning close to Akash, making faces to distract him as he finished the cereal.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, are you feeling all right?"
"I'm feeling fine. I was just hoping for a vacation for my vacations," he said. "The doors are working their own way."
She nodded. "I understand." She did understand, for deep down she knew there was nothing wrong with her father. Though it upset her to admit it, if anything, he seemed happier now. Her mother's death had lightened him, the opposite of what it had done to her. He took a worn white handkerchief from his pocket, wiped remnants of milk and cereal off Akash's face. The gesture reminded her of being small, and the little ways her father had come to her rescue, pulling out a handkerchief if she'd spilt food on her clothes, or needed to blow her nose, or had scraped her knee.
"Let a few days go by. Maybe then we can take a boat ride."
After breakfast, Akash had his weekly swimming lesson. She expected her father to stay at home, but he said he wanted to go, bringing his video camera along. He offered to drive them to the pool in the rental car, but because the car seat was in the SUV, Ruma drove. She had learned to drive in high school, but then for years she had lived in cities and not owned a car, so that until now it was an activity she associated only with visiting her parents, taking the car to drop off videos, or going with her mother to the mall. It was something she had to get used to in Seattle, having to fill the car with gas, making sure there was air in the tires. Though she was growing familiar with the roads, with the exits and the mountains and the quality of light, she felt no connection to any of it, or to anyone. She had exchanged only pleasantries with her neighbors, a retired husband and wife on one side, two gay professors at the University of Washington on the other. There were some women she would talk to as she sat watching Akash in the swimming pool, but at the end of each class they never suggested getting together. It felt unnatural to have to reach out to strangers at this point in her life. She was used to the friends she'd left behind in Brooklyn, women she'd met in prenatal yoga and through a mommy group she'd joined after Akash was born, who had known the everyday details of her life. They'd kept her company when she went into labor, handed down the clothes and blankets their children had outgrown. Those friends had been a 5 or 10 minute walk from her apartment, some of them in the building itself, and back when she worked part-time they could meet her at a moment's notice, pushing their strollers through Prospect Park. They'd gotten to know Ruma's mother when she came to visit on weekends, and some of them had driven down to Pennsylvania for the funeral. At first, after the move, these friends sent Ruma emails or called from their cell phones as they sat in the playground without her. But given the time change and the children always at their sides, it was impossible to carry on a meaningful conversation. For all the time she'd spent with these women, the roots did not go deep, and these days, after reading their emails, Ruma was seldom inspired to write back. The car was silent apart from the sound the tires made on the road and the slicing sound of cars passing in the opposite direction. Akash was playing with one of his toy trains, running its wheels along the surface of the door and the back of Ruma's seat. She was aware of her father quietly monitoring her driving, glancing now and then at the speedometer, looking along with her when she was about to switch lanes. She pointed out the grocery store where she now shopped, the direction of Mount Rainier not visible today. "That's the exit Adam takes to go to work," she said. "How far it is?" When she was younger, she would have corrected him. "How far is it?" she would immediately have said, irritated, as if his error were a reflection of her own shortcomings. "I don't know. I think it takes him about 40 minutes each way." "That's a lot of driving. Why didn't you choose a house closer by?" "We don't mind, and we fell in love with the house." She wondered whether her father would consider this last remark frivolous. "And you? Have you found work in this new place?" "Part-time litigation work is hard to find," she said. "Preschool is only until noon, and Adam and I don't want Akash in a daycare." "In order to practice here, you will have to take another bar exam?" her father asked. "No, there's reciprocity with New York." "Then why not look for a new job?" "I'm not ready yet, Baba." She had not bothered to contact any firms in Seattle, not called up the trusts and estates attorney one of the partners at her old firm had given her the name of, suggesting maybe Ruma could write briefs on a case-by-case basis. She realized she'd never explicitly told her father that she intended, for the next few years, to be at home. "We're still getting settled." "That I understand. I'm only asking if you have a time frame in mind." "Maybe when the new baby starts kindergarten." "But that is over 5 years from now. Now is the time for you to be working, building your career." "I am working, Baba. Soon I'll be taking care of 2 children, just like Ma did." "Will this make you happy?" She didn't answer him. Her mother would have understood her decision, would have been supportive and proud. Ruma had worked 50-hour weeks for years, had earned 6 figures while Romy was still living hand-to-mouth. She'd always felt unfairly cast by both her parents into roles that weren't accurate, as her father's oldest son, her mother's secondary spouse. "They won't be young forever, Ruma," her father continued. "Then what will you do?" "Then I'll go back." "You'll be over 40, it may not be so simple." She kept her eyes on the road, pushing a button that turned on the radio, filling the car with the determined drone of a reporter's voice. She had never been able to confront her father freely, the way she used to fight with her mother. Somehow she feared that any difference of opinion would chip away at the already frail bond that existed between them. She knew that she had disappointed him, getting rejected by all the Ivy Leagues she'd applied to. In spite of Romy's itinerant, uncertain life, she knew her father respected him more for having graduated from Princeton and getting a Fulbright to go abroad. Rumah could count the arguments she'd had with her father in one hand. In high school, after she'd gotten her license, he had refused to insure her on the family car so that she could drive it on her own. In college, when it was time to declare her major, he had tried to convince her to choose biology instead of history. He had balked at the cost of law school, but when she'd gotten into Northeastern, he had paid for it all the same. And he had argued when she and Adam were planning their wedding that an outdoor ceremony was unwise, recommending an institutional banquet hall instead of the bluff on Martha's Vineyard she and Adam desired as a location. As it turned out, the weather was perfect, the sun beating brilliantly on the ocean as they exchanged their vows. And yet, even to this day, Rumah suffered from nightmares of the white tent and folding chairs and hundreds of guests soaked by rain. She pulled into the parking lot where the swimming pool was. Inside the building, she told her father to wait on the benches where they could watch the class through a window, while she went into the locker room to change Akash into his bathing suit. When she joined her father, he was busy with his camera, putting in a new tape and adjusting the settings. "There's Akash," she said, pointing to where he sat, wrapped in a towel, waiting for the class to begin. She had thought Akash was too young to go into the pool without her, that they would have to take the earlier class in which parents went into the water as well. But there were no spots in that class, and from the very beginning, Akash had separated from her willingly, leaping into the arms of the instructor, an auburn-haired teenage girl. For the next 30 minutes, her father taped Akash continuously, having the flotation device strapped on his back, jumping into the pool, blowing bubbles, and practicing kicks. Her father stood up from the bench where Rumah sat, the lens of the video camera nearly touching the window. He had not paid this sort of attention when Rumah and Romy were growing up. Back then, it was their mother who sat watching their swimming lessons, who held her breath, terrified, as they climbed the ladder and waved at her, then plunged off the high diving board. Her father had not taught Romy to throw a baseball, and he had not taken them to learn to skate on the pond, a short walk through the woods behind their neighborhood that froze every winter. In the car on the way home, her father brought up the topic of her career again.
"Work is important, Rumah, not only for financial stability, for mental stability. All my life since I was 16, I've been working."
"You're retired."
"But I cannot stay unoccupied. That is why I'm traveling so much. It is an extravagance, but I don't need all the money I've saved up." "Self-reliance is important, Rumah," he continued. "Life is full of surprises. Today, you can depend on Adam. On Adam.